The practice of meditation is, on one hand, it's quite easy. You know, it's almost, you can look in the meditation manual and learn and read about the instructions and just do it. But when it comes down to the practice, from the theory to the practice, we find maybe it's not quite so simple as we think it is. Because we're dealing with ourselves, our human minds and bodies, and I think for most people they aren't quite so simple as the thought is, but maybe it's just my interpretation. At least my mind isn't as simple as the book said it was. Anyway, but in the practice, it's I realize that many times it's presented in kind of a, what I would call a fundamentalist way. You sit down and do this exercise, A, B, C, D, E, and maybe if you're lucky, well, E is actually enlightenment, went too far there. A, B, C, D, and then, then the enlightenment. That's what I thought 35 years ago. I'm still working on the D, actually. What's the E again? But I realize that's just an idea, that's just a concept or a theory we have in our minds. And what the Buddha is actually trying to guide us or lead us towards is another way of seeing. You could say direct experience, if you like, rather than just kind of analyze or have a theory about your mind or body. Actually experience it directly, kind of break through, as it were, the ideas about it or the theory about it to the direct experience. And this is quite, in one way, it's quite a radical transformation of our understanding. That's when understanding gets transformed into wisdom then, actually knowing about ourself. We're actually knowing ourself, rather than knowing about ourself, which is the understanding, but knowing ourselves directly. Then there's trying to put together then the various aspects of our experience. I mean, sure, it's important, and especially in the beginning anyway, to have a, you know, a simple practice. You know, we can emphasize that Buddhist practice, anybody can do it. You don't even need to be a Buddhist. Anybody who has a body and mind can do it. Sit down, watch the breathing. That's just the encore. So yeah. That's just the introduction, and then see what happens. Sit down and watch the breathing. Look at your mind. See what happens. And then all kinds of, and then the story gets interesting. Then after that, and of course there is the goal. You know, why do people come to meditation? They come for maybe some. Maybe they have some fixed idea about what they want to get. And that can even limit people sometimes by having a fixed idea. They have an idea what enlightenment is. People have all kinds of ideas about what enlightenment is. Where I think the easiest or the least misleading way of putting it is just trying to experience the way things really are. Rather than enlightenment, and you know, we think of, I think of anyway, lights and, you know, being praised by the celestial beings, and music starts as soon as you have your breakthrough. Yesterday I was sitting here in the meditation afternoon, sitting in the chair up here, and I think, I don't know, about 3 o'clock or something, I was sitting here and then my mind lit up. Aha, what's this? And it was just the sunlight coming in the window up there. I thought I had it for a minute. By the time they rang the bell, it already moved. And so, well, if it's impermanent, it's not enlightenment, obviously. But then, you know, just being able to sit there and actually observe the changing thoughts coming and going, the sensations in the body coming and going. I mean, you know, where's the celestial symphony, you know, to that? at another level, deeper level, there's great peace in that. That's what's happening. That's the reality. There's no argument. There's no conflict. There's no argument. There's no disagreement. It's just what's happening. Very simple, but not kind of very spectacular in a sense. I was kind of reflecting about how to put together these various elements of our being. I think last time I talked about spiritual practice being a mixture of work and play, isn't it? Enjoyment and work. And probably most of us have some expectation of some enjoyment, unless you're a masochist, maybe. I mean, we expect, you know, enlightenment or spiritual practice to lead to some kind of enjoyment or positive experience. But sometimes it doesn't just fall into our lap. Sometimes we have to actually work at it a bit. That is, develop the exercises, for example. Another kind of way to look at it maybe is in terms of relaxation and effort. Because on one hand, to say we're just trying to waken up to the way things really are, it sounds like, well, just relax then. Just open your mind, relax to the way things, because it's the way things really are is already happening, right? So what do we have to do about it? We don't need to do anything, really, in a sense, because it's already here. But can we just relax into it? And I noticed, I mean, there is that tendency, there is that movement, if you like, in spiritual practice. Some people take it quite far and say, you know, there's nothing to do. Nobody can ever do anything. You either got it or you haven't. Sort of win or lose, I guess, or you're born with it or you aren't, or something. Then the other side of it is effort, putting forth some effort. I mean, I would say myself that the Buddha emphasized the effort part a bit more. Because the whole principle of kamma, action, laid out an eightfold path, development of meditation. At the same time, you know, if it's just based upon effort, depends upon the kind of effort. I mean, if you're making effort to realize your expectations, or realize your ideas about what it is, or chasing a fantasy maybe, or chasing an illusion all the time. So at one level we need to balance these out, if you like. That's between these two, relaxation and effort, probably it needs a careful balance. Even though the Buddha emphasized a bit more effort, but that's not it either. Maybe a fundamentalist would say effort, 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 just do it, keep working. And you know, for certain people, they have to emphasize quite a bit of effort. Just like I was reflecting upon this, what I said last time about enjoyment and work. Yeah, it's not really a balance. Yeah, it's not really a balance in that, I think. You know, some people, they have to do more work than others. Some of us have a lot of work to do. Some people find spiritual practice very easy. Yeah, they come to meditation and just sit there and whew, they're away. Others have to work at it. Where I ordained in Thailand, wasn't in Ajahn Chah's monastery, it was somewhere else in North Thailand. And it was a meditation monastery, actually. And there's two of us ordained there, myself and another man. But I didn't stay there. I had another monastery to stay, a forest monastery. So the other man stayed there, and he had done meditation before in Germany. So he thought he knew all about it. But he just knew about concentration, really. Didn't know about insight meditation. So the teacher was going to show him the difference. So in this monastery, there was a novice, quite a few novices, but one of the novices there was quite notorious, actually. He was kind of the archetypal naughty novice. He was forever throwing rocks at the dogs, and when he walked past my meditation hut, he would knock on the wall, you know, and peek in to see how I was meditating or not. And you kind of wonder, what was he doing in a meditation monastery? I mean, he was always up to little tricks and always annoying people, annoying the animals. And so the teacher, well, he was going to teach this other Westerner the difference between concentration and insight meditation. So he went into the meditation hall, and then he called this novice in. Come in and meditate. And this Westerner thought, what's he calling him in for? This guy can't meditate. I mean, he's just running around and, you know, annoying everybody. But the teacher called him in and sat him down and said, can I meditate? This novice, well, he wasn't little. He was maybe 18 or so. So he sat down and just crossed his legs and boop. He immediately dropped into a very deep state of concentration. And this Westerner kind of looked at this. What? Just a minute ago, he was running around chasing, annoying the dogs, and now he's sitting there like a brass statue. And the teacher touched his hand, nothing. He even got a needle and pricked his hand with a needle. He felt nothing. Just sat there. Then the teacher snapped his fingers and said, okay, come out of it. And he came out of it and started chasing the dogs again. He said, concentration, no wisdom. So it wasn't about just sitting there. Maybe you have to put some work into developing insight meditation. But this young boy, apparently, he had been, shortly after he was born, he could just have get into these very deep states of concentration. So his parents didn't know what to do with him, sent him to the monastery. What else can he do? He just sit there in deep meditation. And then the monastery was an insight meditation monastery, so he went to the right place. I never heard what happened to him, but whether he got enlightened or what. But for some people, then they have to do a bit more work at the practice. And the same with relaxation, between relaxation and effort. For some people, if their way of approaching meditation is a little bit too devoted to willpower, they want to get something, they want to get some results. I think in general, most of the Westerners who came to Thailand, you know, we were very highly motivated because we traveled all the way halfway around the world to go to Thailand. So Ajahn Chah would emphasize a bit more, just relax, slow down, relax. I mean, not fall asleep, but I mean, be a bit more relaxed. You know, he had so much ambition or so much desire to get results quickly. I gotta get enlightened before my visa runs out, you know. Hopefully not too long. I went to Thailand originally for one whole month, see, devoting a whole month of my holidays to meditation, to get enlightened. Well, that was 35 years ago. Still working on it. But then for the Thai monks, he would actually give much more encouragement to making effort, to you know, work harder, you know, do more practice, work harder at it. This is a very valuable opportunity now. You come to the monastery and you're born in a Buddhist country, and so come across the Buddhist teaching quick, put forth the effort. But for many of the traditional Buddhists, they think, well, this is just one lifetime, see. Don't want to rush it, you know. If I work too hard, I might get enlightened, and then, well, what to do next, you know? But also, there is a kind of relaxation. Depends upon, it's not part of the Eightfold Path, but I could say maybe there's a right relaxation. It's like, you know, what are we relaxing into? If we don't have, you can say, don't have right understanding, maybe we relax into ignorance. You know, if you do notice that the body is relaxed, and maybe you notice it's a bit sluggish, your mind's a bit dull, maybe it's lazy relaxation. If you're relaxed and the mind is clear and there's some, you know, vitality in the body, then maybe that's right relaxation then. Where the body is all tensed up, you know, there's effort there, energy there, but you got a headache too, maybe, because you're so tensed up and too rigid. And then you notice that the awareness cannot expand. You can hold your attention on the breathing and hold your attention on a certain meditation object, maybe, good concentration, but not a lot of flexibility in that, not a lot of space in that. Maybe you have to relax a bit more. Yeah. And some people, they maybe relax and then they just collapse, maybe. But maybe it's a good place, actually, a good start. Because they have to maybe relearn the right attitude to approach. And this practice is only based upon willpower. Yeah. I'm going to sit here and get enlightened, through thick or thin. And just following some kind of concept or idea about it. And maybe if they collapse, they can re-establish another, a bit more balanced approach to the practice. Behind all of these, you know, the different factors to balance out, the different areas of our experience to put together, is the fundamental Buddhist teachings about conditionality. There's lots of conditions here that we have to wake up to, first of all, be aware of. What are the conditions of the body right now? What are the conditions of the mind right now? And how to work with them? Rather than just imposing a certain fixed idea, okay, mind, be quiet. Yeah, that's just a good idea, isn't it? What does the mind say? Shut up. I'll tell you, I'll show you who's boss. You tell me to be quiet, I'll tell you how noisy I can be. Rather than, if we listen to it, open to it a bit more, what's the condition there? Is the mind quiet or is it busy? What kind of activity is in the mind right now? Sometime maybe there's very, I can say, skillful activity. Sometime maybe your thoughts are actually kind of reflective thoughts. There's a reflectiveness there, actually contemplating various aspects. What's this sensation in the body? What's the nature of this activity of mind, for example? Is it a memory? Is it a thought of the future? Rather than just quieting it down and say, oh, no, the mind should be quiet. There we're missing a very valuable opportunity that this is a wholesome or skillful, beneficial way of thinking. If your thoughts are, oh, I think I have to go there, I wish I went there, it would be good if I went there, I'd like to do this, I'd like to do that, well, is that beneficial? Is that useful? Is it wholesome? Or does it just give you more, your mind just spins around and you get busy? Yeah. So noticing what kind of mental activity is going on. Some is useful, some is beneficial. In the formal teachings, they talk about, kusala and akusala, which is what is wholesome or skillful and what is unwholesome or unskillful. And of course, this goes right back to, say, formally, it's the kind of precepts to follow, skillful activity, refraining from unskillful activity, and we get some guidelines from it. But I think this can only take us so far. And then I think we have to maybe change it around. I was reflecting on those words, wholesome and unwholesome, and it works for a while, but then at least for me, it doesn't work anymore. And I realize maybe I have to put it to something like beneficial. That means, does it work? And does it work for you? We can have these general, kind of principles of what is skillful or unskillful. But then we have to maybe bring it home to our own experience now. Does it work for you? And this means, this also implies we try it out and find out for ourselves. If your mind just goes blank, for example, you come into meditation and you take up the meditation object and your mind goes blank. Well, what kind of quiet is it? Is it dull quiet, Is it kind of the quiet of a water buffalo or something? Or is it awakened quiet or alert quiet? And then maybe we can use that now, that quietness. Not just that we could use it as a way to settle the mind, to kind of re-empower the mind. Like when the mind can be actually take a bit of a rest from its activity, you find it gets kind of recharged. And there's a new energy arising there. Other times, people's mind go quiet and they just fall asleep because they're so used to being kept awake by their thoughts. No thoughts are there, so it must mean sleep. But, you know, is it what kind of mental activity or what kind of quiet is there? And, you know, you can say, in general, quietness of mind is wholesome. But does it work for you? Is it beneficial for you to sit there like in a dull state? You know, it's peaceful. You can say you got calm, but not much clarity. You know, is it really beneficial in the long term? Okay, maybe you're not having a lot of worrying thoughts or, you know, unpleasant thoughts, but is it really helpful in the long term? Or just creating dull states of mind, or creating dissociation or something? When maybe sometimes, actually, you know, bringing some skillful activity into the mind can be more helpful. Yeah. The mind, instead of the mind going dull or blank, maybe to bring up a little bit of inquiry into it. What's going on here? What's happening in the mind? What's the state of mind right now? And okay, the mind is not so quiet, but it's more beneficial. Now we're bringing in an inquiry into it, a reflective ability, and using now the mental processes in a skillful way. If the thoughts are just, oh, maybe it's this and maybe it's that, not so helpful maybe, but to use it as an inquiry, what kind of quiet or what kind of activity is there? This can sharpen the awareness. And maybe transform what before was just a kind of a dull quiet, dull calm, into not only a more clearer state of mind, but more like insight, more clearer seeing now, what's going on, rather than just seeing dullness or something. That's seeing something too, but behind all of this, what we call spiritual practice and Buddhist spiritual practice is guiding us or leading us towards direct experience of the way things are. And as I mentioned, this is to be quite a radical change. What's really pointing at is the processive nature of reality. Like I mentioned, I think I mentioned in the very beginning about the exercises. You know, first of all, I used to say, sit here and look, observe the sensations. But sensations are objects, aren't they? Aren't they objects? Isn't it a noun? Sensations is a noun, right? The body has things in them. They have sensations in them. But if we actually look at the body more carefully, more clearly, there's no thing there, is there? There is no such thing as a sensation. There's only sensating, right? See the difference? But before we saw as a body, a thing, an object, a thing, we look at it more carefully, there's no thingness there. There's just activity. Just sensation. Oh, that's an object again. English is not a very good language. Maybe I'll speak in Thai. English is a very kind of object-oriented language, maybe. Huh? It's not very dynamic, you know, but it's hard to explain what's actually, when we're actually observing what's happening in the body, there's just sensations. There we go again. There is sensating. The body is sensating only. It's not a body, a thing having sensations, having another object. There's just sensating as a dynamic living process here. When you begin to observe the states of mind, here again, states of mind. That's a noun too, isn't it? Yeah. Where's your state of mind? You know, is it Washington or is it Oregon or is it California? Or here you'd say New South Wales or Queensland, right? No. No. Okay. better talk about American states rather than Australian states. That's too close to home, isn't it? But a state of mind already implies there's some boundary, there's something there. But when you begin to observe the condition of the mind, what do we see? Just movement. There's just mental activity going on. Where does actually one particular state begin and the other one end? As we begin to see more clearly the way things are, we don't see any more objects or things. We see no thingness. We're seeing processes, dynamic processes going on. Everything's constantly changing all the time. And this is quite a radical way of seeing reality, isn't it? You know, I mean, where am I? You know, I'm always changing, you know. This, I understand this is a good thing, you know. I don't think myself is worth preserving anyway. Or aspects of myself aren't worth preserving, they aren't holding on to. It's good that they keep changing. As long as they change for the better, I guess. We're changing in the right direction. But who knows? We don't know where these, you know. I mean, something like your states of mind. I mean, as we get older, your states of mind maybe don't get any better. They get different. And maybe you forget a lot of things, but start having more senior moments, and then some people say, well, that's not very good. You say, it's very peaceful. Because you're racking your brain. What was that person's name? You say, oh, you know who. Or something. And just forget about it. Let your mind rest. In the quiet. But the Buddha is trying to, you know, with the meditation instruction, trying to lead us to that experience directly. Now I can mention the story. Let's see, at this point. Maybe I'll wait. No, I think it's the right point. No, not yet. I have to talk about what this means as a direct experience now. In one of the scriptures, the Buddha gave these instructions. Somebody asked him, what's a very succinct or direct teaching that they can go and meditate? They didn't want to have a long sermon and have to remember it. They wanted a really short, succinct one. Maybe one night I'll give one. So anyway, this succinct teaching was in the seeing, just the seeing. In the hearing, just the hearing. In the cognizing, just the cognizing. And when you can just do that, there's no more stories come out of it. There's no more creating complications, interpretations around it. There's just the seeing, hearing, cognizing. Simple, right? And it's very dynamic. There's just the seeing. Unfortunately, you know, the whole nature of a self is that it needs an object. You know, the subject needs an object. So it's very hard for most people. They aren't able to just be with the seeing. You got to be seeing something, right? I am seeing something, rather than just be with the seeing. They're just the seeing. That's what's happening. That's a direct experience. But, you know, the old habits are there for most people, especially if they're strong identification with themselves. Just being with seeing, well, you know, what do I do with it? You know, if I see something, I can do something with it. I can control it. I can hold on to it, or I can throw it away. But just the seeing, sort of like, you know, not very interesting or not very useful anyway. But then if you recognize that, if you can put awareness at that point of just seeing, very peaceful. It's a constantly dynamic process, just seeing. But what the old habits come back, and oh, I'm seeing this. Then all the stories start. I'm seeing this, and I like it. I don't like it. I want it. I don't want it. Blah, blah, blah. Last time I saw a clock, and all the stories go on. And we aren't present anymore. We're not seeing anymore. We're already caught in all the stories about it, and all the complications, and then all the emotions, and all the memories, and all the rest of it. And got a headache already. With the seeing, you might have a few eye aches, but no headaches. Just the seeing, just the hearing. Then I was contemplating one of Ajahn Chah's teachings, which is a little bit radical. Maybe I'll have to edit it out of this talk here. But one of Ajahn Chah's teachings, it was a little bit unusual. He said one time, I better get it right here now. He said something like, You know, the scriptures say the arahant, the enlightened being, has no greed, aversion, or delusion. He says, but I think they do. But there's nobody there to own it. See the difference? There is greed, aversion, delusion, but if you don't grab hold of it, you don't, there's no subject, no person there to grab hold of it, no problem. This, you know, greed, or say, greed's another noun, isn't it? You say something like desiring. Can't say greeting, can we? Well, I can say it. You're greeting all the time, or desiring happens. See, desiring's going on. It's like seeing. Desiring is there, but you don't hold on to it. You don't make anything of it. Not desiring anything. See, there's no thing there to desire. Desire just there, just like, you know, it's like a natural process in the body. You know, the body desires food. I mean, you can get down to an intuitive level or instinctual level. The body desires food. But if you now, I desire this kind of food, and I got to have it, and then it becomes an obsession now, then it's, you know, it's not very Buddhist anymore. Now you've got greed, you know. But if you just are aware of, well, there is that tendency, there's that movement, there's that dynamic process now of desiring. That ends right there. It doesn't need to be fulfilled. It doesn't become a compulsion, or it doesn't become a defilement. And the same with aversion, you know, or greed, aversion, delusion. Aversion. I mean, every human being, every sentient being has aversion. We don't want to get hurt. You know, I must admit I have a little bit of aversion to the cold. Does that make me impure or something? As long as I don't create a big problem out of it and say, okay, I'm gonna start a movement to ban cold or something, or or maybe I'll start a coalition to encourage global warming, maybe. At least in Wellington, let's keep it local. I don't want to get too globalized, you know. But if I just recognize there's aversion, you know, there's this tendency, this pushing away, this resistance. But if I don't fix it on a certain object, then I don't build a self around it. And go around and saying, oh, I don't like cold, I'm going to get rid of cold, I'm going to conquer cold, I'm going to kill cold. And then, gee, I'm tired already, just thinking about it. But I can be aware of the reality is there is aversion there. There is averseness, aversing. Angering, I don't know, aversing. I don't know how you can put it in English. There is pushing away or something. They can make it active, make it verbal, see? Make it a verb anyway. And delusion, you know, there's confusing. Kind of, there's this is not going to work. There's deluding there, confusing there. But there's an activity, see? Just like seeing and hearing, there's an activity. And if I don't make it into a fix it on an object now, then it's just the way it is. It's a dynamic process. It rises and passes away. When it fixes on something, then it gets more fixed, ossified, solid, attached to. And at the same time, we build up a sense of self. A subject and an object now gets created. The problem gets really big now. But just the seeing, the hearing, the desiring, the aversing, the confusing, these are just active processes. And we're aware of this, aware of what's going on, and don't make a big issue out of it. What Ajahn Chah was implying was, you know, when there is awareness, when there is clear knowing about what's going on, you know, these things arise, but because there's no identification with them, it's like they don't really have any effect. So there can still be, you know, confusion arises or whatever, all these experiences arises, but if you don't hold on to them, make them into some issue, they pass away. They just arise and they pass, they arise and they pass. What happens is that our usual way of relating to reality is with objects. You know, so, you know, confusion arises and I hold on to it. Oh, I'm confused. How do I get rid of confusion? Then I'm doubly confused. You know, there's the confusion there, and then I'm confused about how to get rid of confusion now. Or aversion arises. I have anger now. And then I grab hold of it, and now I get angry at the anger. And now it gets bigger and bigger. If you recognize that anger is just a natural process, there is resistance, there is aversing. And we don't turn it into an object, we don't identify with it as a subject, rises and passes. Just processes, empty processes. Nobody home to make anything of it. That's one thing to realize it, to know it or see it, but it's something else to live it. It takes some transformation. So, you know, the classical approach is that when there is much more concentration, then this concentration can actually allow these insights to go much deeper into our being. And the other side of it is that to have a way of life which we can live it. And it's one thing to have to go to a retreat and have even quite valid insights. Then we go home to our old habits again, which are object-orientated, which deal with self and object again. And we on the retreat, it's all arising and passing away, and all arising and passing away. We go home and everything is solid. And it's arising and staying there. Doesn't pass away anymore, it just stays. But the point of the experience, you know, by moving our practice, or you could say, from the theory to the direct experience, is a transformation happens. This is the whole to do with the conditionality of all things. And even when you're sitting there and you think, well, nothing's happening, you know, I'm just observing the sensations in the body and the thoughts going through the mind, you know, where's the insight? Where's this thing called insight going to come along and bop me on the head? You know, you're actually living it right now. And, you know, it may take some while before you actually can notice the transformation, because most of the time, those old habits are very strong. You know, you go back, and then we sit here and we're observing for some time, move into the mind, the change of sensations, the sensating body, and then at the end of the meditation, the bell rings and say, oh, I wonder what I have gained. And I come screaming up again. I haven't learned anything. This is but a boring meditation. Oops. Rather than noticing, you can even notice the arising of that sense of I into it, trying to hold on to it and make it into something now. Trying to make the experience into some meditation object I can hold on to and say, look, I've learned this. I can take it home with me. Somebody asked the Bengali meditation teacher, Deepa Ma. Maybe you haven't heard of her. She died in, I think, quite a few years ago anyway. But I was just reading a book about her. So I know the story, but never met her myself. But she was reputed to be an enlightened master. And somebody, one of the Westerners asked her, said, oh, this kind of enlightenment experience sounds a bit gray, you know, like no passion, no desire, no anger, you know. Sounds really dull and boring. And she just laughed at him and said, you misunderstand completely. I mean, what's really dull and boring, really gray, is your ordinary state of consciousness. Because you're with the same self all the time. Every morning, here I am again, the same old story. She said, that's the real grayness, you know. But when you don't have any, when you've gone beyond greed, aversion, delusion, basically gone beyond the identification with the self, everything is completely new every moment. Everything is totally alive and dynamic every moment. Now that's not gray. But every time you turn to your mind and the old stories start up again, now here I go again, you know. There's that part of me, and there's that story of me, and the same old story. That's pretty gray and boring. Eh? Unless you've had a very colorful life. But how many times can you play it? Replay it. Then it gets a bit worn out. But when you're with the seeing, see, right in that moment of the seeing, what's happening, it's perfectly fresh and clear every moment. But with you with the seen is something you've already lived, you've already experienced, and now you're with the interpretation. And it's sort of dead and lifeless. You know, it's just the old stories going on again and again and again. But with the seeing, the hearing, the cognizing, it's a fresh experience, completely fresh every single moment. That's what it is to be aware of the processes rather than the things, the objects. You know, this is what the development of awareness can do, that we're with the presence, whatever is going on. And of course, you know, it's probably not something that just happens like that. It is a transformation. There's a transforming of our way of viewing reality. So, you know, at one level you may notice, you can actually abide with that, seeing, you know, especially when, usually when the experiences are reasonably pleasant. Huh? Sure, I love to see my, you know, pleasant states of mind. But when they start to get unpleasant, then, well, that's old stuff. That's not me. Then we aren't able to maintain that immediate awareness anymore. We go into our old reactions again, the old habits of pushing it away or ignoring it, or greed, aversion, delusion again, the old stories. But the more that we persist with it, we're relearning this new habit, if you like, this new way of seeing, and we begin to recognize a more subtle level to it. There is a peace with it. It may not be so, you know, exciting, but there is equanimity, there is tranquility, there is a peace there. And there's no conflict, because that is reality. That's the way things are. We're turning things into objects. It appears that we have control, but we don't. We're just going to end up with frustration and loss, and it's not going to work. This process begins to work on us. You know, the more you can be with the seeing and the hearing and the cognizing, with the awareness of what's going on at any particular moment, whatever it is, you know, beyond the judgment of it. The judgment is already in, you know, going into, oh, I like it, I don't like it. It's already made into a thing. Well, there just is processes going on. You don't have to go that far anymore to liking and disliking. That's just what's happening. Then we were able to recognize then, you know, what, maybe you can say what right relaxation is then. Relaxing. Directly relaxing, not relaxating. Relaxing into the present moment, just as it is. Yeah, but now it's relaxing into the present moment as it really is, not into some interpretation of it or, you know, some misinterpretation or some delusion about it, but that's how it is. You know, and this is where then the relaxing and the effort come together. You know, because the effort has kind of pointed us in the right direction, and then we can open to what the processes are now. And then these two don't have, they aren't in contrast. There isn't a dualism now, there isn't separation. The effort and the relaxing come together. You can say relaxed effort, or effortless relaxation, or something. Yeah. See if it works. I'm working on it. You know. Relaxed effort. I think I like the relaxed version first. As you get older, you know, the effort gets harder. Relaxation gets easier. Anyway, they come together more easily then. Instead of one or the other, you know, for most people it's either they're either relaxed or they're striving, one or the other. But to try and put them together now, when they come together, that's when the conditionality, the conditions all come together, and we find a mutuality between them. And this has only come from experience, because of thinking about it, you know, the whole nature of thought is in contrast. You know, black and white and up and down. The way that thinking is, it is only in contrast. You have to make an effort to, you know, to bridge the gap and to provide mutuality. But our experience, direct experience, can experience that, can know that directly. And that's how it really is. You can actually tune into a very relaxed effort, or some effort within the relaxation. You can make an effort to be relaxed. Well, maybe try it. That's where all these, and that's where the, you know, also enjoyment and work come together. You know, the work and the play becomes the work, and the work the play, because if you're all the same then. Those dualisms, those dualities come together. That's just the way things are then, in these processes, direct processes. No more things, you know, conflicting things, just processes. So I hope that was reasonably clear. Wasn't to me, but here I was talking about a process, kind of trying to rationalize, sort of theorize about a process. But anyway, it was probably your meditation was better than the thinking about it. So I think I better pause there this evening.